If you had a magic wand and you can make some changes that would improve the quality of service that individuals get from a nutritional standpoint, what do you think can be done?
I think that the medical field, or medical industry, as I would call it, needs to adopt a medical / coaching hybrid. That is, I think, the most important piece. Dietitians need to become coaches. And I honestly think that viewing dietitians that I've seen in the different places that I worked in, they don't understand coaching as much as they should. I can't even say that's something that can be taught. Like, I don't know if you can teach somebody to do that. I think that's something that you learn in practice of coaching people. Like, the majority of what I learned about coaching people is I learned from my clients.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Dr. Joey Munoz Show, your go-to podcast for all things nutrition, health, and fitness. I think I said those in the right order. I feel like I say those in a different order every single time. I'm your host, Dr. Joey, nutrition science PhD and founder of Fit for Life Academy. Today, I had a wonderful conversation with my very good friend, Darone, the owner of Eat Right Nutrition. Him and I used to chat back and forth all the time on social media, promote each other's stuff. But Darone has been missing from social media for a while because he's been deep in the trenches doing his master's in dietetics, his dietetic internship, and doing his thesis work as well, which we discussed a good amount on this episode. He talked about his different rotations during his dietetic internship, what those look like. So it's going to actually be a pretty interesting conversation for you guys to listen to really know about what goes into becoming a dietitian and becoming a professional in the field of nutrition. My background's different. I have a PhD, which is completely different than going down the dietetics route. The dietetics route is more applied. My field is more on the development of new science, right? So you get a PhD, you do research. When you get a dietetics degree, you actually work with individuals and you do different rotations. You work in hospitals, you work with kids, you work with all different sorts of populations. So it's going to be a really interesting conversation for those of you guys that just want to learn a little bit more about the field of dietetics and learn more about my good friend Darone. Thankfully, he's getting done with his internship and he is about to go all in on his business again and be back on social media. I highly encourage you guys to give him a follow and check out his podcast as well. And all the links to that will be in the description. And we mentioned it a couple times throughout the episode as well. For those of you guys that have been following along on my social media, we have officially launched the Fit for Life Academy membership. And I've been talking about that. I actually released an episode. Well, when this releases, it'll have been like 2 weeks ago now. I recorded it just a couple days ago, talking about our launch. So our membership is a low ticket membership. It's a coaching membership for anyone who is looking to improve their overall health and body composition, trying to improve healthy dietary habits, lose some body fat, again, build some muscle, improve body composition. And they want to do so in a healthy and sustainable way with expert guidance. And they want to be part of a kick-ass community of individuals who are all working towards the common goal of looking a little bit better, being a little bit healthier. So if you guys are interested in learning more about that, head over to our website, fitforlifeacademy.health/membership. I'll put the link down in the description as well, so that you guys can learn more about what the service entails, what's included, and all of that good stuff. With that said, let's go ahead and get right into the episode. Hope you enjoy. What's up, my man? How are you, bro?
I'm good, Joey. I haven't spoken to you. I mean, we've spoken through text a little bit here and there, but I haven't actually spoken to you probably since I saw you in Florida.
It's been too long, man. I'm happy that you're back on here.
Yeah, I see you've been doing some pretty cool stuff. And you were recently on Julia Michaels' podcast, right?
Yeah.
How was that?
It was cool. She saw one of my debunking videos, the one where I was talking about Gary Brecka with like blended fruits spiking blood sugar or whatnot. And she saw that and she really liked it. So she reached out. It was cool. We talked about a couple of different nutrition related myths. One was like blending fruits. Is it bad? Is it not? I'm talking about the science there. We talked about a couple of other myths. I can't remember what they were, but just like similar related topics. It was cool.
Did you talk about the time that you debunked her?
Nah, I don't think I had. Did I? That was lame.
Maybe it was lame. But I feel like everybody debunked her at that time.
Yeah. Dude, the cool thing is that she like acknowledges that she's wrong with stuff, because like Lane called her out hard, and she's had Lane on the podcast like two or three times as a nutrition expert, and we talked about it too. Like, we kind of joked about it. She was saying how like hard Lane came at her, and she was like, you got to understand, like, these things I share don't necessarily come from me. They come from some experts that I work with because I'm not an expert. And I'm like, fair enough, you know, like fair enough. So I know she says some controversial stuff, but I respect people that are willing to acknowledge when they've said something wrong and be like, no, I was actually wrong, and like not have a big ego about it. It was cool.
Yeah. Rather than just brush it off, ignore it, and then, you know, move on like nothing ever happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I hear you, man.
Dude, so what have you been up to, man? Where'd your hair go?
I decided to cut it. Full disclosure, I'm losing a little bit on the top, on the crown here. So I'm like, you know what? I might as well just, I'll take it off. And the man bun is like kind of mixed reviews. Like some people are like, thank God you finally cut it off. And other people are like, oh no, I love this. It's like 50-50. So I don't know. It was time for a change. I just decided to... you know, cut my hair, and now here I am.
I like the man bun, man. I feel like I know you because of the man bun.
Yeah, well, you didn't know pre-man bun, so that's why.
What was pre-man bun? Just short buzz?
Yeah, I've been all over the place. I had a hard part at one point with the line buzzed in the middle. I've been all over the place. I had a faux hawk at one point. No, yeah. I like to switch it up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Classic New Yorker.
That's it, basically.
But, awesome, man. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I just finished my dietetic internship per se. I mean, I still have, I'm still taking the class that goes along with it, but because I had prior assessed learning, I didn't have to do the final rotation because I did research in the lab, which counted towards that. Okay. So that was the last 200 hours. So I just completed the internship part, which was honestly pretty brutal. Just from a time standpoint, you'll see I've been like MIA on social media. Now I'm starting to get back on the bandwagon. I have 4 podcasts recorded. This will be 5, and then we're recording another one later today. But it's just been like a grind, man, like 40 hours a week plus clients in the morning before I go to the internship, clients when I get home, and then addressing like school assignments and thesis and stuff like that. And now I'm happy to check that off the list and that it's behind me, and I'm just working on my thesis, submitting that by the end of April, and then I graduate and then take my dietetic licensing exam. So I'm excited, and I feel like I actually thought about it the other day. Like, passing that exam, you find out right away whether or not you pass the exam, and I just like pictured myself getting that grade and passing, and I'm like, man, that's like a monumental moment because I've been working really hard to get that done. So I'm super excited to get that done and then, you know, continue with Eat Right and continue to grow.
Yeah, dude, I'd love if you share a little bit about that. What have you been up to? And for those people listening to who didn't listen to the first episode we did, give a little bit of context, like your background and then why you decided to go the dietetics route, what you've been working on, what a dietetics degree actually looks like. I honestly don't even know what a dietetic internship actually looks like. So I'd love to learn a little more.
Okay. So my background was in competitive bodybuilding, personal training for 15 plus years at this point. And I kind of always knew I wanted to go down the nutrition route. 2013, I graduated with a bachelor's degree in nutrition and dietetics. And then fast forward, I took some time off. I was personal training, working, still doing nutrition coaching, working as a nutrition program coordinator for Lifetime Athletic. And then the pandemic hit, and I said, you know what? Perfect time to A, start a business, and B, you know, go back to school, get my master's, and finally get my license. So bachelor, master's in nutrition and dietetics, or almost master's. Dietetic internship entails a few different rotations, which is the first rotation I did was community nutrition. You go into all different areas. It doesn't necessarily have to be what I did, but that's where I was placed. Community nutrition for me involved working with Head Start programs in the Bronx and basically going to multiple different locations where these kids basically aged like 2 to 5. And we manage a lot of things there. So we manage the children, we look at their medical charts, we see if they have any issues, height, like growth issues on their growth charts. Any weight issues, what's their BMI. We look at what their eating habits are like in the classrooms. We actually engage with them in the classrooms, and we connect with parents if we think that there is some type of issue or disordered eating pattern, and we want to kind of get a feel for what they're doing at home, what they're eating like, or is there a variety of different foods? What are they cooking like? Are the kids eating out often? Like really what's going on in the house, and kind of getting the parents involved. And then obviously following what we call CACFP guidelines, together with New York State guidelines, which I have kind of some issues with, but the overall guidelines are like how many servings of grains are they having? They have to meet in order for the facility, the Head Start program, to get funding from the government. They have to meet criteria in each meal. So certain number of grains, certain number of vegetables, what counts as a vegetable, meat or meat alternative. Like I mentioned, one of the issues that I have with New York in particular, and I saw this in my clinical rotation, which I can get into also, is the meat substitute thing comes from the mayor, for Mayor Adams. Once he got elected, he's a big plant-based guy. And he believes that we should basically substitute everything. I mean, if he had his way, everything would be substituted. In my clinical rotation, the default now I worked in a public hospital. The default now is plant-based. So unless you are a patient, inpatient, and you request animal proteins, by default, you're going to get something like jackfruit is a big thing on their menu that they're like, well, this, you know,
God. So the meat substitute isn't even like a high protein alternative. It's just a vegetable that looks like.
Not necessarily. Right. So with the Head Start program, it seems like the dietitians there, the dietitians were responsible for actually creating the menus in the Head Start program. So having like beans as a meat substitute or like tofu as a meat substitute.
Sure.
Would be great for an option of protein, but in the hospital having like jackfruit, you know, I don't really know 100% what the requirements are. Like I'm very familiar with it for the children in the Head Start program because we actually worked on creating those menus and I had to do the data analysis on the menus and what the macros were. Was it too much saturated fat? Was it not enough fiber? The amount of fiber that they actually expect the kids to have now through New York State are to me, like, I mean, you know, you and I are big proponents of fiber being a very underrated nutrient. And the majority of adults in America getting about 15 grams when they should be getting 25 to 35 or 38. The recommendations in this case with the kids, it was almost impossible for us to put together the amount that they wanted. They wanted like 14 grams per day per kid. And keep in mind that the kids aren't eating all of their meals at the facility. So they're just having a breakfast, a snack, and a lunch. And we're expected to fit 14 grams of fiber in all of those things and meet the rest of the criteria. So it was a little bit difficult from a fiber standpoint. I honestly think that whoever from a government standpoint decided that, first of all, I don't think that they're really nutrition experts. And secondly, they kind of it's almost like they set it up for failure. Because from a fiber standpoint, like, yeah, we can push and drive fiber, but maybe only two meals out of an entire week would actually meet the criteria. Because you also have to keep in mind that with children, you want variety. You want to increase their exposure to different types of foods so that, you know, even culturally, you want to increase the diversity of like the cultural, different cultural foods that they're eating, right? In their neighborhood that they're in, it might just be predominantly one or two different cultures. So it's very difficult to keep all of that in mind and at the same time try and create a meal plan that is going to work and have like fit every single piece. It's kind of an excruciating process, right? Because you put together a menu and then you look at it and you're like, oh, well, this doesn't work now. I need to swap all these things out.
Yeah. And in addition to that, getting the kids to maybe actually like it too. Because kids are super picky eaters typically. Was that an issue you guys ran into at all? Something that you were considering?
Absolutely. I think for the most part, a lot of the kids were open to it. But there are certain things. So we'd get feedback from the cooks, which we were also really involved with them too. We had to make sure that, you know, temperature regulations and all of like the food safety stuff was in place. But we'd get feedback from both the cooks and the teachers in the classrooms. And there were certain items that if we gave it to kids like on a reoccurring basis, they'd be like, well, the kids don't eat this. We need to take it off the menu.
Yeah.
And part of the issue that we dealt with was, well, if we take it off the menu, that's not enough exposure, right? We want to give them exposure to something over and over again. And we want to kind of encourage kids to, I mean, you're a father, right? You know.
Yeah.
You want to encourage kids to even just, okay, don't eat it this time. Just play with it, right? Just kind of mush it in your hands because they're very like sensory, like texture oriented. So if you get them to, I don't know, bounce a pea off the table and have fun with it and create like a fun activity, eventually, hopefully they'll eat it. So we shy away from just because they're picky, we're not going to put it on the menu. And we try to encourage them, like, let's see how many times we can put this on the menu before we make that decision to take it off the menu.
Yeah. I just had, do you know Dr. Taylor Arnold? Her page is Growing Intuitive Eaters.
Okay.
She's great. She's a pediatrics nutrition expert. I had her on the podcast. I think the episode was published last week, just talking about, overall nutritional strategies to help kids become healthy eaters, in a healthy way, in the sense of like her whole thing is developing intuitive eaters. So getting kids to have autonomy over food and not be, ashamed over their bodies or whatever. And she shared some really cool stuff. One of the things she was talking about is like letting kids play with food, because so much of the way that kids learn is through play, right? And sometimes they just like won't try something because it's something new and it may look scary or weird or whatever. And they're like, I don't want that. You just let them play with it, smell it, feel the texture, whatever. Eventually they put it in their mouth. So that's cool that you guys were doing some of that too. Like just because a kid doesn't want it doesn't mean they're not going to have it on their plate. You're not forcing them to eat it. But at least they see it, at least they get the opportunity to touch it, and hopefully that encourages them to eat it over time. So that was one of your rotations. What else did you do?
So then I went on to clinical nutrition. And clinical was actually the one that I was kind of, I don't know if I want to say afraid of, but it was just a completely different world to me. Because I'm used to, I guess, what in the clinical setting they would call outpatient nutrition, which you're not dealing with people that are necessarily sick, right? They might have like, hey, I've got high blood pressure, you know, high blood glucose, I've got, you know, type 2 diabetes, whatever it is. But when I got there, I was actually really shocked because I don't think that anything that you see, like we do case studies in school all the time and you're like, okay, like this person's blood glucose is, you know, like 200. Or 150, right? It's elevated. But then you get to the hospital and you're like, okay, this patient is DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis, and their blood glucose is like 800, 900, right? And I'm like dealing with numbers that I've never even imagined were possible. And I think a lot of it, you know, I think of it like this. So my father, growing up, my father's insulin dependent, type 2 diabetic. It runs in my family, but you know, some of that is eating habits. And I used to think like, oh man, like all of the detriments of type 2 diabetes, like, you know, on your nervous system, your kidneys, right? Diabetic retinopathy, diabetic peripheral neuropathy, right? Like all of those things that you learn that can happen with diabetes. What I really learned is that the medications are actually really good at controlling blood sugar if they're taken properly. And a lot of those issues are really becoming an issue where people don't take their medication on a regular basis. And I would have conversations with patients where I'm like, okay, are you taking your diabetes medicine, whether it's metformin or, you know, whatever the case is. And they'd be like, oh, well, I took that a long time ago. The doctor prescribed that to me like 3 years ago and I took it and I finished it. And I'm like, well, it's not like an antibiotic where you're, you know, you finish your 7-day course and then you're done. Once the bottle's empty, you got to refill it. And I found that there's a big knowledge gap.
Yeah.
In dietetics and in medicine. And this is one of the things that I want to touch up on because I really got to see firsthand how the medical system is in terms of insurance and billing. And it's just crazy to me. Like so you and I work from a coaching standpoint, right? And we meet with people and hold them accountable on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. And when you look at what you can build with insurance, especially like something like Medicare and Medicaid, and I always feel like the people who are on Medicare and Medicaid are the people that need the most attention and the most nutrition counseling, and they get the least from a coverage standpoint, right? You have insurance companies that will cover 26, 27 sessions, which if I was meeting with somebody weekly, that's like 6 months. I can make some change in 6 months. I can educate somebody in 6 months.
Yeah.
But when you have something like Medicare and Medicaid, and they're covering 3 nutrition consultations, and I'm speaking with the dietitians that work in the outpatient clinic at the hospital, and they're like, yeah, we meet with somebody once or twice a year. And I'm like, well, how are you going to make any change, right? Nutrition requires the accountability, the reinforcement.
And back and forth conversation.
And back and forth conversation and questions. And you tell somebody something and they're not going to remember it fully. They might remember bits and pieces of it. And my thing with nutrition, well, it's something that I've always said with Eat Right, is you can, like at Eat Right, we don't want to just change your nutrition and your fitness. We want to change your life. And the reason why I always say that is because you have to change how somebody identifies with themselves, right? The identity shift. There's lots of research on psychology and nutrition and fitness that will point in the direction of, if that person doesn't change who they are, they're not going to make that long-lasting sustainable change. So then my question is to the medical community, how is somebody going to change their identity in 3 visits?
Yeah.
So
it's practically impossible, man. That's difficult, man. It's, I obviously don't know how that world operates at all. And then I can obviously imagine that that type of individual, like the individuals that we work with, are people who are seeking help, which implies that they have some degree of baseline knowledge already. And those individuals require a good amount of help as well, right? Like, 3 sessions for somebody who we work with for coaching wouldn't be sufficient either. And I can only imagine that these types of individuals that you're discussing or talking about require even more help than that. And then the thought that I was thinking the whole time when you mentioned that these are people that like haven't even taken their medication, just like how difficult must it be to get someone like that to make lifestyle change if they can't even prioritize taking medications on a regular basis, right? It's sad, man. Like, it's sad because what's the phrase? You can guide a horse to water, but you can't make him drink some shit like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm getting it wrong, but like...
No, I think that's exactly it.
Yeah. It's difficult, right? Because it's like the person needs to have some motivation on their end. And it's crazy because even some people, diabetes specifically, right? Like how many people get their leg amputated because of diabetes-related complications? And the things that they can do to improve that, in theory, are really simple, right? Like get adequate nutrition, get some movement in, like these small little things that will actually help. But how do you get somebody to change? That's a completely different question. How did you approach conversations with clients during this? Because obviously you have a coaching background. I'm sure a lot of the dietitians that you worked with don't. So what were some of the things that you did? Did you have any like really cool stories with any of the patients?
It was hard. It was difficult.
Yeah.
I don't know that I'll be honest. I don't know that was the environment. I refer them to outpatient, but even knowing that I referred them to outpatient, like, I'm like, all right, cool. Like I'm going to talk to this person. We give them some handouts. We educate them in the room. We talk about some do's and don'ts, some things that you want to optimize. All of the stuff that you and I will speak with clients about on a regular basis, right? Is, you know, optimize your activity to increase insulin sensitivity or reduce insulin resistance, however you want to look at it. You know, stay away from predominantly processed foods. Let's manage your fat intake. Let's manage your calorie intake. But it's hard, man. It's honestly,
you can't,
there's not much that you can do. And a lot of these times I'm seeing somebody once, maybe twice. I mean, there were some patients, I saw a lot of amputees, since you bring it up, those patients, you know, depending on if they had an infection associated with it, a lot of it is associated with infection. They were in there for a while. I found because I was in a public hospital too, there was a big language barrier too. So a lot of what I did was through an interpreter through the phone. So it's tough because I feel like when you're coaching somebody, you're dealing with a lot of differences in, and you have to be able to adapt to the situation that you have. You're dealing with cultural differences. You're dealing with potentially language differences. You're dealing with education gaps,
yeah,
potentially, right? And people need time to learn things, I guess is my point. And I don't think that the environment is conducive to that. And even if you refer them to outpatient, if they don't have the insurance that's going to cover it, that's just a whole different conversation.
What do you think are some things that can be done to improve? Improve the way that the system works overall? I know it's a tough question.
Yeah.
But if you had a magic wand and you can make some changes that would improve the quality of service that individuals get from a nutritional standpoint, what do you think can be done?
I think more coverage. And I think what I've learned from this, more coverage from an insurance standpoint, I think that the medical field or medical industry, as I would call it, needs to adopt kind of like a, this is how I view kind of Eat Right in the future. I'm kind of back and forth on whether or not I want to accept insurance once I can do that. But I want like a medical / coaching hybrid. That is, I think, the most important piece. I think that dietitians need to become coaches. And I honestly think that viewing dietitians that I've seen in the different places that I worked in, they don't understand coaching as much as they should. And I don't know if that needs, I don't know if, I can't even say that's something that needs, that can be taught. Like, I don't know if you can teach somebody to do that. I think that's something that you learn in practice of coaching people. Like, the majority of what I learned about coaching people is I learned from my clients.
Yeah.
You get what I'm saying? Like, yeah, you can learn, like I've learned in school, cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing. Those principles are great, but your clients are going to be the ones that are going to teach you how to apply them, because they're going to give you obstacles that as a coach, you're going to have to figure out how to get through those obstacles with that client. It's a team effort. And I feel like that is missing from the medical field.
In what sense? It's just like one-way information, essentially.
Yeah. And I think that, listen, the team needs to have team meetings every single week.
Yeah. Is there much integration between the medical team and the dietitians in the hospital setting, or not really?
So there is, depending on who the medical team is. Depending on what floor you're on, depending who the doctor is, depending who the nurses are. For the most part, I'll say yes. They do kind of refer to, and it really depends. So what I've heard from professors and other people that I've spoke with that work in that side of nutrition, it really depends where you are and what kind of a culture they have in the hospital.
Gotcha.
The culture that I had here seemed to be one of kind of mutual respect. So I was kind of grateful for that, where doctors would send consults to dietitians because they saw the value in it. And then dietitians would do the things that they specialize in. Because the other things that we do is the tube feeding. If somebody can't eat orally, right, NPO, or if like TPN, total parenteral nutrition, or parenteral nutrition, where they're getting an IV and they're getting nutrition through that because maybe there's like a stomach cancer or some type of obstruction or something and the gut just doesn't work. So you have to feed them through other means and give them nutrients through an IV. In those cases, it's, you kind of have to refer to the dietitian because the dietitian is really the only one that has the training in that aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the questions I was going to ask is, does it seem like the medical team, the medical providers, respect and emphasize the importance of nutritional intervention? Right? Because I feel like most patients are like, my doctor, what my doctor says. And if perhaps the doctor doesn't emphasize the importance of the nutritional intervention, that could be another contributing factor as to why it's not as effective, right?
Yeah.
And I think you answered by saying it depends on the culture and where you're at.
Yeah, I would say for the most, I honestly do think that I have faith that from that standpoint, with yeah. especially with all the research coming out on the importance of nutrition, I really think medical system is moving in that direction. I don't think it's moving. Yeah. I don't think it's moving fast enough in that direction. I think there's a lot of room for growth there, but I do think that it's being talked about at least.
Yeah, dude. What was I about to ask? Oh no, don't let it. Okay, I remember now, dude. I hate this. I think of a question for like 5 minutes, and then when it's time to ask, I forget. what were some things, you know? Because you have a science background. You love reading research. You love staying up to date with actual nutritional science. Was there anything with regard to the dietetics, education, information that you received that rubbed you the wrong way, that maybe wasn't extremely accurate or the most effective? And I'll give some examples.
Yeah.
So I can follow up on that question, because I've had friends that have gone down the dietetic route that were doing their PhD alongside me. I remember one story specifically, like, my friend was doing her dietetic internship. She was taking some classes, and some of the dietitians were really emphasizing how bad eggs were for your blood cholesterol, right? And so they were telling all the patients like not to eat eggs and stuff like that. Did you experience anything like that?
I don't think I did, honestly.
Okay. Maybe it was just where I was at. The hospital was shitty.
Yeah, I think I was actually fortunate enough to work with some really good, really talented dietitians. That part of me was kind of like, what are you guys doing here? Like, you can do
so much more
than what you're doing here. And, you know, it's kind of like an eye opener to me too, because it's, you know, we've talked about business and stuff and, you know, kind of doing your own thing and running your own business or practice or whatever it is. I'm like, man, I do not want to live that life. Like, I do not want to yeah. succumb to, you know, the 9-to-5 grind. I'm not getting paid enough, and this is my life. The dietitians that I worked with were actually, I learned a lot from them, especially in a clinical setting. In my community nutrition, I had a really excellent, super nice preceptor that came from a really good background. So I got a lot of pieces of different kind of avenues and aspects of nutrition, which is what realistically the internship is for. For most students, it's, hey, like, we want to like expose you to these things, and then you can decide what avenue you want to go down, right? It's kind of like a physician going through some clinical rotations, right, to figure out what they want to do. In my case, it's a little bit different because I'm already doing what I want to do. I just want to kind of further my career doing what I'm doing. Yeah. So and then the last one was food service, which was the world's worst rotation ever. I actually, like, midway through the rotation, I was like, let me look at what other dietitians have experienced. So, like, I looked at, like, Reddit forums where dietitians would talk about their food service rotation. And I asked other dietitians, and they're like, yep, that's about accurate. One of them on Reddit described it as the Subway rotation, because she said she's never made so many sandwiches in her entire life. It was a lot of like,
have you chef met up back there?
It was a lot of like chopping vegetables and doing like work on like working as a food service worker, rather than, when you think about food service management for dietetics on that track, what it's supposed to be is menu development, nutrient analysis, pricing and cost, right? Profits, like all of the things that make a kitchen, or basically like kind of like a restaurant run, right? But these are like larger scale kitchens.
Sure.
That was not the experience. I had some assignments from school that required me to do some of that stuff. And then other than doing like inspections, I learned a lot about New York City, like code violations and stuff. And I had to do the weekly inspections on the kitchen and make sure they were up to code. But outside of that, it was like 99% I'm a food service worker. And I'm like, what am I? I cannot. I'm counting the seconds until I'm out of here.
Yeah. Can you chop veggies super quickly now?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess.
You got the technical skills. Keep it right by the thumbs.
Yeah, I'm an expert. Yeah. I should be a chef now.
All jokes aside, man. So now that you're getting done with this, how has your perspective shifted in terms of the stuff you were doing before, what you wanted to do, how you're going to be implementing some of this knowledge in your business moving forward?
So I think for the most part, like 85% validated, like you're going in the right direction. You're on the right trajectory. Keep going and do more.
Yeah.
The other piece that I realized is I'm oftentimes hard on myself for like thinking I don't work hard enough and I don't do enough. I don't know if you kind of share that experience.
Yeah, I think we all do, especially if you run your own business. I think that's the downside of it is that as when you work for yourself, you don't have like a list of things that you need to get done and your day is over, right? So I always feel like no matter how much you do, there's always more to do. So it just feels like you've never done enough. And it's, for me, I just have hard boundaries around like work time and I just get what I can get done in that time frame and that's it. And that's helped me a little bit. Because you still have that feeling. For me, it just makes it makes me feel comfortable knowing that I have particular boundaries and I do the best that I can to get as much done within those boundaries and then just call it a day at 5 p.m. and that is what it is, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's, I mean, everything has pros and cons, man. I guess when you have a job, you have the peace of mind of like, I did my job, I'm done with work. And you don't have the thought of like, I didn't do enough, because that's not what it's like, right? You have an 8-hour day, you do what you got to do, and then you're done and you did enough. I feel like when you work for yourself, it's always a feeling of not doing enough, always the feeling of not progressing quick enough, always the feeling of falling behind compared to others, always the feeling that maybe you're going in the wrong direction or the feeling that your business is going to fail. Like, I think those are also commonalities amongst people that are ambitious and want to accomplish something, because those are the things that keep you going, right? Like the opposite of that is if you didn't have any of those feelings and no matter how little work you did, you felt like you've done more than enough. Well, you're not going to go very far, right?
So to that point, that is kind of the feel that I got. I always worked in a gym as a personal trainer and I only knew what that culture was like.
Yeah.
And that honestly, that's a grind, right? You're always on the phone. You're always trying to get clients. Client drops off, you need to replace them. You're training like eight to 10 hours a day. You're doing a lot. You're programming when you're not training. The environments that I feel like, I almost feel like, so you said like the opposite is you're doing a little bit of work and you're like, okay, I'm done. I've done enough. I feel like that's what it's like. Like, I feel like in an 8-hour day, that's what the work environments are like based on what I've seen.
You try to be little as possible to get by.
Right. And I feel like an 8-hour workday is more like a 4 or 5 hour workday. And then the rest is like 3 to 4
probably
hours.
Probably less than that.
Yeah. Right. But it's like the rest is like, okay, 3 to 4 hours of just like bullshitting with your coworkers. And then, okay, I'm going to go home and I'm on a salary. So.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what I did today. So I'm actually grateful that I'm in the position that I am, where as much as I put in is what I get out. And I just prefer it that way, partly probably because I've been a trainer for so long and that's just how it's been. Listen, I've been a commission employee for basically my whole life. So, you know, I never really had the opportunity or the luxury to just sit back.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot about how people work and how much work I actually put in to what I'm doing. I do think that I would want to tackle a little bit more of the medical side of nutrition because I can, and then move the business in a direction. I still want to do coaching always, first and foremost. And I want to be that bridge between what we talked about, the medical side of things and the and the coaching, like that has to be bridged together, and the programming, and that has to be done. So I'm really optimistic about kind of the future direction and being able to kind of put all these pieces together. And I also realized that I have the capability to hire dietitians to specialize in things that I don't want to do. So for example, pediatrics is something that I know I'm totally not interested in, even though I worked with pediatrics in my internship. And my thesis for school was really pediatrics based too. But it's not something in practice, like I feel like if you're a pediatric dietitian, like you're just doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, opportunities are endless.
Hey guys, some of you may not know that I'm the scientific advisor for a supplement company called Outwork Nutrition. I help with the formulation of new products to help ensure that they're effective and backed by science. Unlike many other supplement companies out there, we don't rely on exaggerated claims or flashy marketing tactics. Instead, we let the science speak for itself. We take pride in formulating products that deliver real results, helping you achieve your fitness goals in a meaningful way. If you're in the market for supplements like protein powder, pre-workout, or recovery products, make sure to check us out at outworknutrition.com. And as a thank you for being an avid listener of this podcast, use code Joey for an exclusive discount at checkout. You can find the link to our website down in the description of this podcast episode. Remember, our goal is to empower you with science-backed supplements that truly make a difference. Choose Outwork Nutrition and elevate your fitness to new heights.
Yeah, and different people enjoy different things, obviously. You know, for me, what you were saying before about like an 8-hour work day and just like kicking back, like, dude, for me, I've never really had that experience either because I've always jokingly said I'm a horrible employee. Because I just can't do something for 8 hours and I'm not motivated. Like if there's no difference in what I earn, if I work hard or I don't work hard, I'm not going to work hard, right? That's just my nature almost. And it's definitely not a good mindset to have, but also I hate feeling forced to do things that I think are stupid. And I feel like there's a lot of that in normal jobs just because of the way things happen when a business really grows and there's hundreds of employees and there's a certain way things are done and it's not questioned. And to make change would take a lot because a million different things need to change because it's been corporately structured in a certain way, right? And so for me, like if I had an 8-hour work day and I can get my work done in 4 hours and then I'm forced to be there for another 4 hours, for me, that's like being in prison, dude. I hate it. You know, oftentimes with my work days, like I make a list of what I need to get done. I get it done and then I'm done for the day. It's like, hey, I got some extra time. I can chill. That's my reward, right? So it's funny how different people operate because some people don't mind it. Some people crumble under the stress of like having to figure out what to do for yourself because that's something that is difficult too, right? Like nobody tells you what to do. Figure out what you need to do. And you're the only person holding yourself accountable. And I'm not going to say I'm great at it either because there's definitely days where I fall short and I'm like, damn, like I really screwed up today. But then it's an ever learning thing, right? Where you get better at it as well. That's one thing I've noticed too. Like the more you practice things and this goes into like the whole fitness thing too, of like consistency, but like practicing little things, like even just being consistent with work and like making a schedule, you get better at being efficient. You get better at getting more done in less time. You get better at being more productive. I don't know. I guess I'm just attracted toward things that allow me to get better the more time I put into it, right? And a normal 9-to-5 job, it's like, yes, you can get better at your job, but there's no sort of reward associated with that. And for me, man, like that's the worst thing in the world. I know you're similar in that respect.
1,000%, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, so are there some things in the works right now? I want to know. I want to I want to have the secret, know the secrets.
Podcasting is coming back. Sweet. I haven't. And I mean, we went, almost 3 years strong, 140 episodes strong. And we're shifting a little bit. A lot of it is going to be more of this, like kind of interview based.
Yeah.
And so we've got some episodes coming down the pipeline very soon. Social media content. Obviously, we're getting back on the ball with that. And really just growth and just, I'm going to start with what we have now and kind of working on that and refining everything that we have now. Newsletters are coming. I actually I have this thing called Bite-Sized Nutrition Facts, and it's got like my
You told me a little bit about this.
So yeah, I'm gonna start doing that and put out like almost like I think it's called Snacks. There's like a or Daily Snacks or something like that. There's like a newsletter that I'm subscribed to that kind of sends me that kind of stuff. So I'm looking forward to just putting out more educational content. And I do want to get into, it's like once I graduate and I'm settled, I definitely want to get into YouTube. And I know you and I have talked about that. It's like a whole nother beast. I want to get into more of the long form content. The podcast is obviously long form content, but that is what I have in the works right now.
Cool, man. It's funny that you brought up the newsletter thing, because I was just thinking about this earlier today, because the newsletter is the one area where I have really slacked. I was putting out weekly emails for a while, like pretty in-depth educational emails. And then I stopped, and now I just send like a weekly recap of my podcast content and just promotion for my podcast. And it's mainly been because, well, I have a lot on my plate with the social media, the podcast. I post the podcast on YouTube, so it's just repurposing there. But then if you think about the purpose of a newsletter, for the most part, it's obviously adding value and driving traffic towards your business, right? And for the longest time, I just had my one-on-one coaching, and I've always been fortunate enough to have a full client load without needing the newsletter. So I didn't really emphasize it much, but I'm not sure if you've seen, I've been promoting a new service I just launched on Instagram, which is essentially I've wanted to, for the longest time, have a low ticket membership service that offers some coaching experience for individuals without the one-on-one component. And I've been working on this for a little bit over a year now, and we're officially live, just launched today, actually. And for those of you guys listening, we're recording on the 29th of March. This is probably not coming out for like 2 weeks. So I'm talking to people in the future. How cool.
Amazing.
Time is not real. Anyways, we won't get into that. But go ahead.
I think it's important to have multiple different offerings for different people. Definitely having a lower ticket offer, because listen, one-on-one coaching is expensive and not everybody can afford it. Not everybody sees the value in that. Yeah. And for some people, they might join the community and then decide, hey, I want to do somebody who wouldn't have done one-on-one coaching will decide through that, I want a little bit more than what I'm getting right now, and then do one-on-one coaching and greatly benefit from it.
Yeah. Or the other way around too, because I have so many clients who work with me one-on-one for some time and they want to continue working with me to a lesser capacity, but I don't have anything to offer until now. So I definitely want to pick up on the newsletter thing again. And I was thinking about like how to structure the newsletter, and the whole thing is like focusing on healthy habits, focusing on hypertrophy training specifically from a workout perspective, because most people want to look a little bit better, build muscle. And then the other pillar is mindset and community. And so maybe having a weekly newsletter where it's just like one little tip on each of those pillars is kind of an idea that I had. We'll see what direction it goes. I want to share with you what I'm doing with the membership, man, and get your perspective on it if you're cool with that.
Definitely, 1000%.
So the main thing I wanted to do was essentially take everything that I do with clients with one-on-one coaching and distill it into a membership. And obviously it's way more affordable, but not lose the value of all the stuff that we work on with one-on-one coaching. So what we've done is we've developed a whole host of different hypertrophy training programs, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days per week, beginners, advanced, at the gym or at home, and for men and women. Different areas for women, it's more like lower body focus. You have a little bit more focus on glutes than upper body. And so we allow clients to select between the training programs. We update those every 8 weeks for a new mesocycle. So that's one aspect of the service. And this is all done via our app that we developed too. You get enrolled in our Healthy Habits program. So this is like the habit-focused approach to nutrition and lifestyle. And so it's a sequential program where every week you work on a different habit around nutrition and lifestyle. And so you receive the habit on day one, and then you get educational resources for the habit. You get daily tips. So for example, week one, you work on protein consumption. You get a nice educational resource on why protein is important, how much you should be consuming, as well as some high protein food sources. So you can actually develop the habit. And then every day you get like a tip in your inbox that tells you, hey, like do this to include more protein, little tips to help you include more protein in your diet. And then you get recipe packs. So like a high protein recipe guide, high protein snack guide. And so we have that structure every single week with a new habit. And right now we're working on 12 main habits, and We probably might add a couple more, but it's some of the basic stuff that you and I always talk about, right? And then once they go through it, it restarts, because realistically, you're not going to develop all of them by just going through it once, right? And then the other aspect is that we're really emphasizing community. So we have forums built in our app where we're going to do weekly Q&As. The goal is to get to the point where we can run Q&As daily. So if somebody needs support, they can hop on a live call and there's a coach there. So as the membership grows, we want to hire out new coaches where they have responsibilities in the community to run Q&As. Would love to get to the point where we have like one Q&A in the morning, one Q&A in the afternoon, almost daily, so people have the support they need. And then the last aspect is that we're going to do technique feedback. Do you follow Coach Bernardo?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So he's my partner on this. He's like handling all the training side of stuff. So he did all the workout programs, and he's going to collect workout videos from my clients on a weekly basis. Probably pick out the best 30 to 40 videos and give technique feedback and post it in the forum so people learn how to train correctly too. Because I see so many training apps, man, and people just buy a workout plan. And like, that's great. Like, a workout plan is important, but like actually training correctly is way more important, right? So that's what we're trying to address with the technique feedback. And that's pretty much the overview of the service, man. Like I said, we just launched today. I'm super excited to continue growing this. And we'll see what direction it takes, really.
Yeah, that's something that always, I had a difficulty transitioning from one-on-one training to the online stuff because of technique.
Yeah.
Where I was like, I always was like, no, because people have dysfunctional movement patterns and they don't know, you know, they don't have the proper kind of proprioception where the awareness of their body and the positioning, right? So I always had an issue with that. And then online, I just started, like, if I suspect something with a client, I'm like, send me videos. I want front, side, back. I want to see everything. I'm going to critique it. I'm going to give you a full breakdown of how to do it. And then, you know, if it needs to be corrected, send me a video again once you've corrected that.
Yeah. That's exactly what I do. Is it as efficient as working with someone in person? No. But there are many routes to get to the same outcome, right? Like, it takes a little bit longer, but it's still helpful. I mean, we have education on what proper technique looks like for different exercises. We emphasize the importance of like range of motion and tempo and pausing in the lengthened position. And then we've recorded videos for all of our exercises so that we know that the videos that we're sharing are good technique for people to mimic. And then we're going to do the technique feedback. I think that's really the best we can do online, because again, it's the limitation of not being in person. But I've seen it be super helpful and super effective with my one-on-one clients, man. Like, yes, it takes some time, but if they continuously give you the same exercise videos every week, you give them little tips, they're really mindful about it, they implement, it slowly improves. If I think about it, like, I didn't have a personal trainer teach me anything. Everything I learned is just like through consuming content, right? YouTube, articles, this, that, like, and it took years, but I feel like I've been able to learn how to train properly just from consuming content, like watching my own videos. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I would say this. Imagine if we had the help, because there are so many things that I did not so great for probably a very long time until I learned. And obviously, if you're kind of involved more in like the fitness community and you surround yourself with people that help you correct things, that's helpful too. But I almost feel like with coaching, it's grown so much that like people have an opportunity that I don't feel like I had when I started training. I don't think that was a thing. Like, Lane Norton was probably the only person doing online coaching basically before it even existed.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's kind of like a pioneer in that aspect. And I don't feel like the opportunity that people have now, it should be taken advantage of, because it's huge that it's available anywhere.
Yeah. But also, like, for us, it's a benefit that we went through those difficulties, because they were great learning experiences. And we know what some of the common mistakes are, because I'm sure you've made them as well. I mean, I've made a ton of them. Absolutely. And I've gotten hurt a million times lifting too, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
Doing stupid shit.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, you do. You go ahead, please.
I wanted to ask you something while we're on here. So your thoughts about research.
What about
being somebody with a PhD who's done research, in terms of accuracy of data? So this is one thing when I was working on my thesis and I was dealing with food frequency questionnaires was the data that we used, right? I see you like rolling your eyes already. It's just so hard for me to like, I feel like the data sets a lot of times are just like absolute trash. Did you ever feel like that?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think food frequency questionnaires are not the greatest, obviously, but I think they are when you get data from like thousands of individuals, the data's directionally correct in the sense of like, hey, this person who isn't reporting many fruits and veggies or whatnot, or caloric intake, or like the errors almost cancel themselves out. I think it's a similar concept to how, like, if you tell a client to track their calories and you know that they're under tracking unintentionally, but the error is consistent, it's not that big of a deal. I think it's probably something similar, where maybe the absolute values are incorrect, are definitely incorrect, but the data is directionally correct, right? So maybe a relationship between fiber and a particular outcome, like maybe the different quartiles and average values of fiber intake aren't correct, but the data is directionally correct in the sense of like people who eat more or less fiber tend to have a higher or lower risk of a particular outcome, right? Because I think where people struggle with food frequency questionnaires is the quantity. Like, people know how to report what they eat. They just don't know how to report how much they eat. But if everybody inaccurately reports how much they eat similarly, then maybe it's not that big of a deal when you have data from like thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of individuals, right? I'm trying to give the benefit of the doubt here.
That's where we get into like meta-analyses and combining all
the results. Yeah. And then correlational data obviously has its limitations. I think correlational data can be really powerful when we're looking at like population-based data. Like, we were talking about fiber, right? Like, although it's correlational, we have data from like hundreds of thousands, if not millions of individuals at this point, right? So I don't think it's appropriate to discredit that just because it's correlational data or it's food frequency questionnaire. It's like, yeah, but like, people are not lying about eating 5 servings of fruits and veggies, right? So again, like I said, I think it's directionally correct. And a lot of the food frequency stuff is used for correlational data. And for people listening, like, all data is not self-reported either, right? So like, it's not all food frequency questionnaires either, because we have different types of research. And regardless, when you look at research to make a conclusion or to make a particular recommendation, you shouldn't just be looking at one type of study either, right? So for example, people discredit fiber consumption and cardiovascular health because a lot of it is correlational. It's like, yeah, but we also have mechanistic data understanding why fiber is beneficial. We have controlled clinical trials giving fiber supplements. We have data that's not self-reported with blood biomarkers. It's like, you know, when you look at the whole picture, I think it's pretty damn good. The issue is like, people don't really understand how to look at the whole picture. This was something I went in depth on a while back, probably like a year ago now. Like, Adrian and I were talking about, you know, my buddy Adrian Chavez. We're talking about, because he did a lot of work on omega-3s. And so I was consulting him, asking about omega-3 supplementations, because there's so much conflicting data. A lot of the data that's conflicting is correlational. But then you start to look at some of these confounding variables like population or baseline omega-3 status, and you start to realize that the data is not really controversial at all. You just need to know how to observe the data correctly and know how to differentiate between the different confounding variables. I think it's something similar, man. It's like, people think research is looking at a study. In reality, it's like, you need to look at the overall literature on a particular subject to really understand what's going on.
Right.
Those are my 2 cents.
Exactly. So my thoughts are, unless you've read a multitude of different studies on a topic and really thoroughly understand the topic from the mechanistic data all the way to, you know, the correlational data and the randomized controlled trials, that's really the only way to actually evaluate.
Or if you read something like a meta-analysis, it's super helpful. Just make sure that your frame of reference is within the context of like the population and the methods, right? Because yes, meta-analysis are large scale studies that include multiple clinical trials, but there's still some context there within like the exclusion and inclusion criteria. Like, we only included these types of studies. We only included these types of participants. So the findings can only be not extrapolated, can only be within the context of those criteria, right? And I think this was exactly what we were talking about, like with the omega-3 supplementation stuff, like some individuals seeing benefits and some not, with different types of supplementations, different type of baseline omega-3 status. Like there were some meta-analyses, I think, or large-scale studies, not meta-analysis, and like Asian populations. And they were seeing perhaps, I can't remember in particular which populations were seeing more benefits than others, but essentially certain populations were seeing benefits at lower doses, and those populations had higher baseline omega-3 status. So it's perhaps the fact that they already had a certain amount of omega-3 consumption that the other population did not. And that's why they were seeing benefits at lower concentrations. Obviously it gets tricky, man, but like being able to understand all those things is incredibly important.
Yeah, absolutely. I think,
Go ahead. No, you go ahead again, since you like to talk, Gleeds.
What do you mean? I think, you know, some of the things that I've looked at in the past is like protein research, for example, and
sure.
not even data on outcomes, like data on consumption, really.
Yeah, that shit's all over the place.
Right. And so like the thought that, you know, I've seen some articles, and I did a podcast about this a while back, and I talked about older populations and how they need more protein and reasons why, because of sarcopenia, right? And I talk a lot about some of Stu Phillips' research, where he talks a lot. He, you know, kind of discredits the RDA for protein. Like 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight is not enough. It's actually just enough to not be deficient in protein, but it's not enough to live optimally, I would say.
Sure.
And then you have these articles where these, you know, people from these respectable universities that are like, well, America's consuming too much protein. We have an obsession with protein. And I'm like, all right, so I see the trend and how like we kind of get to that, right? So there are tons, everywhere you go, there are protein products now, right? Protein shakes, bars, protein collagen gummies, like all these things. And when you look at two things, you look at consumption, not from a standpoint of eating, from a standpoint of consumers buying things, right? And then you also look at reporting and what they're reporting, how much protein they intake. And from my experience with food frequency questionnaires, what I've found is that they generally way overestimate. And I found this working one-on-one with people too.
Sure, that, yeah.
You know, they'll be like, well, I easily eat, and I've seen it enough, I've seen it like at least 1,000 times now. Oh, I eat at least 100 grams of protein a day, and they eat like 30 or 40. So, you know, it's like, how do we inform the public when we have this kind of information that isn't necessarily accurate? When you have consumption from like a buying level, well, okay, like how much are they eating? How much is waste? Right. And when you have people reporting and they've never, ever used a food scale in their entire life, how do you actually know how much of something somebody's actually eating?
Yeah. Yeah. I also tend to think we like hyperfixate on small little variables way too much. Like, is knowing the average consumption of protein per person really important? I guess you can argue for some things, but it's not as important as just knowing that like, hey, higher protein consumption is beneficial. And that we can't argue, right? Like, so that's what I'm saying, like with research is like people hyperfixate maybe too much on the little variables of like, Americans eat too much protein. This is their protein consumption. Americans eat too little protein or whatever. It's like, yeah, we know that eating higher protein helps with satiety regulation and it's going to help with body composition. Like, you know, that's, and just find an appropriate protein intake that's accurate or appropriate for you and helps you achieve your goals and be in the health status that you want to be in, right? Like, I do think we hyperfixate on like minutia way, way, way too much. That's why I like to focus more on just like general patterns, especially dietary patterns. And that's why I just don't care that much about like super detailed mechanistic research, not even mechanistic research, but just like stuff that's way too focused on like a particular data point or something like that, because it just doesn't add much value, right? At least from my perspective, I just think it doesn't. And then like you mentioned, people do all of these mental gymnastics over data that maybe isn't even the most accurate data, right? But again, we can probably argue that the data is directionally correct. Even though protein's being overreported, people who are reporting more are probably eating more protein, right? So we can see the relationships between higher and lower protein consumption. That's my perspective on it, man. I saw it like people like Stu Phillips and some other people who talk about like the absolute optimal protein range and 1.6 to 1.8 or no, 2.2 to 2.6. And in this circumstance, this, and in this circumstance, that. It's like, who cares? Just eat a little bit more protein, right? You also don't have to obsess about it. Include protein in all your meals. It's a much simpler approach. And I feel sometimes people may think it's like a cop-out. I just don't think like those minute details matter at all. It's the same as like people stressing about organic versus conventional, right? Or like canned versus fresh. It's like, do these variables have zero effect? No. But can we argue that they have very minimal effects? Yeah. So why spend so much energy on them, right? It's the same. You see it to not talk about nutrition in like the hypertrophy training space, like the optimal rep range or the optimal tempo or lengthened partials versus full range of motion versus integrating partials between full range of motion or doing partials at the end of your full range of motion training and like what's optimal. And it's like so many years of research for little details that just don't fucking matter that much. You know, like it's, yeah. I don't know. I get like it's some people's career and some people enjoy it and that's fine. But in terms of practicality, like recommendations, I just don't focus on that at all.
I think from a training standpoint, I'll definitely 100% say I'm on board with that. I think that generally people will focus on these minute details and it'll almost kind of get in the way of their progress.
Yeah.
Because they're not almost, it will. Because they're not like the biggest factor is, are you working hard enough, right?
Yeah.
Are you coming somewhere close to failure ballpark? Do you even understand what being close to failure, what like three reps in the tank is even feels like?
Yeah.
Are you doing enough volume? Are you progressively overloading? Like those are the big boulders when it comes to exercise programming, to the point where honestly, I've fallen into the trap. I've always, from a standpoint of being formerly a competitive bodybuilder, I always did bro splits. And
yeah.
I always got better results doing that. And I could say, well, maybe I'm an outlier. Or I could say, when I just think less about my training, I tend to work harder. And I also, I've resorted back to that style of training because I enjoy it more.
Yeah.
And that gets me to work harder in the gym. So even though it's not quote unquote optimal,
it's good enough.
And I get results from it. And if it's what's going to get me results because I'm going to work harder because I'm enjoying my workouts, that to me is the biggest thing to really take away from that.
Yeah. And that's the same thing, like same sort of principles that I think you can apply to nutrition. Obviously there's such a thing as too little protein, too little fiber, right? But like, hey, if somebody is eating 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram, we can definitely argue that they're not deficient in protein, right? We can argue that they can build some muscle, maybe not optimally. And I say maybe because I think the protein ranges for body composition are also impacted by underreporting, right? Like it all is. But let's say that person's consuming 1.2 grams, they feel good, their diet's sustainable, they're making progress, they're happy with their progress. They don't really feel comfortable bumping up protein a ton more. Like, why would you argue with that person? No, you have to get it to 1.6 grams per kilogram because that's optimal for building muscle. Like, as long as they're not deficient, they're eating sufficient, we can agree that, you know, if you can slowly increase your protein intake, it might be slightly better, but just increase it to a point where you feel comfortable and you're seeing the progress that you want. And that's really it, right? Like, I use research to guide general recommendations on foods or behaviors that are going to have positive outcomes. But I don't use research to set very, very specific, tightly regulated recommendations because that's just not the way like life works, right? Everybody has different preferences. Like I'm working with a client right now, man. She, I'm pretty sure she's Indian, if not Middle Eastern, but I think she's Indian. And she follows a vegetarian diet. And naturally, she was only eating like 40 or 50 grams of protein, very low. And I wanted to get her to at least 120 grams. And she was really trying, and she got up to like 70, 80 grams. And she was like, hey, this is just like where I feel comfortable. It feels so forced to eat more protein than this. It's just not what I'm used to. I haven't eaten like this my whole life. I feel good here. And I was like, hey, I would love if you try a little bit more, but if you're here, you're better than where you started. And that's really what we're looking for, right? And she's seeing progress towards her goals and she's happy. So like, you know, why would we then try to argue that she needs to get up to 120 because of whatever scientific research says this recommendation's optimal? I just don't care about that stuff too much.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is that research gives you kind of a blueprint and a general direction. And then you have to take that information and go on a case by case basis and, you know, do what's best for your client and what they prefer to do.
And what I want to emphasize here, because I feel like people that might listen to this might think like, oh, then like research doesn't matter at all. And science, it doesn't matter. It's like, that's not true either, because like I said, I use science to guide general recommendations and behaviors. Like we have plenty of science that tells us about specific things that are healthy, right? Like what we're saying here is like not arguing very, very minute details that are highly specific, but we know protein's good, and we know protein's good for satiety, and we know it's good for body weight and body composition. We know fiber's good. We know having breakfast is good. We know having a regular meal schedule is good. We know sleep is good, right? Like now we can argue whether you should go to sleep at a particular time because of your circadian rhythm, X, Y, Z. But at the end of the day, what matters most is that you get adequate sleep, right? So I want people to understand that too, because it's not just like, hey, you can discredit research altogether, because that's essentially what people in like the carnivore community do and say fiber's a hoax because of Ansel Keys. And it's like, bro, do you know how much research there is since then? You know, it's funny when people try to argue the complete opposite of that.
You know, it's like the research that I read a while ago that suggested that, you know, and there's a few articles about this where you, because of your circadian rhythm, speaking of circadian rhythm, there are some, I guess, genes that are downregulated, and you kind of suppress fat burning and you increase fat storage at a certain time of day. It's probably related to, you know, the sun and light and all of those things. But I've never actually taken that to inform clients, because realistically, the way that we live our lifestyles now, like I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? Say you need to stop eating at 4 p.m. or 6 p.m., depending on what time of year it is. It just doesn't make sense. And it's such a minute detail. Like we're just talking about like a difference of like 60 calories, which you can just create a deficit of that anyway. So, I mean, I like the minute details and the mechanisms and all those things, and they're fun to kind of learn about and play around with. But the reality
is
not
what moves the needle at all.
Right. It's where we don't want to, drop a boulder to pick up pebbles. Like it's not going to get us there.
Major in the minors. That's what I, you know, like, I don't dislike Huberman, but that's what he does a lot on his podcast, right? And I think, I mean, I'm not gonna say the only reason he's successful is because he focuses on these minute details. Like that would be silly to say. I think he does a lot of things well. I think he does a lot of silly things too with some of the information he shares. But people seem to be attracted to a high level of detail or a high level of nuance, which is funny because on social media it's the opposite, right? But at least with podcasting, like highly mechanistic, very specific stuff, where in reality, it's like not super applicable, right? I was listening to a Huberman episode where he was talking about like optimizing light for productivity. Just think about how specific that topic is in and of itself, right? Optimizing light exposure for productivity. Not saying, hey, expose yourself to light because it helps your productivity. But now we're going to optimize the type of light that you're exposed to now optimize productivity. And I just clicked on it to like see what he was saying. And I maybe listened to the first like 20 minutes. And it was all about different angles of exposure and different wavelengths of exposure as well. So it was like, hey, in the morning between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m., you should have a light at this angle from your face because of whatever reason. and at this wavelength. And from this time to this time, the light should be more overhead at a slightly different wavelength. You can buy these types of lights here. And buy. I'm like, dude, that's just too much, man.
Yeah.
You know, I like the Alex Hormozi. Do you follow Alex Hormozi?
Of course.
Obviously, his stuff is non-scientific. But he's just like, you know what's going to make you more productive than your four-hour morning routine? Just getting to work in the morning. Like, that's kind of my mindset, where it's like, we waste so much time on these little things that it just prevents us from just doing the thing, you know?
Just paralysis by overanalysis. And yeah. I would argue that that whole thing with the light, I mean, I didn't see it, but that just sounds stressful in and of itself. And what is the stress going to do to you, right?
And I'm like, sure it's not whole... rooted in hardcore clinical data. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The same thing we can tell what you were talking about, like eating in accordance with your circadian rhythm. Like, yes, I'm sure it has a small effect. Yes, I'm sure some genes are upregulated and some downregulated at different times of day. But like, how does that actually make a difference independent of energy balance, for example, right? Like, does it? I don't know. And if you were going to measure that, like, what sort of an effect size does it have? What sort of population size would you need to have to be able to detect that effect size?
Yeah.
How long would the study have to be able to detect that effect? Because I am going to guess here that if it doesn't have an effect, it's maybe a very, very, very minor effect, like 1% or less, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, man, like it just like doesn't matter. If it becomes a burden to not eat at a particular time because of your circadian rhythm, like it just doesn't matter. What's more important is just eating at regular times. You know, we know that is associated with better body composition objectively. So it's for any topic, we can get into the weeds and just like get lost in an infinite amount of information, because you know how research works. When you answer one question, you unlock 20 more unanswered questions. So you never actually get closer to the truth. You kind of get further from the truth, right? It's like you just realize how many more questions there are to answer. That's exactly what I was talking about with like the length and partials for training. I had Dr. Milo Wolf on the podcast. Do you know who he is?
I don't.
No? Okay. So he's like really popularized the hypertrophy training in the lengthened position, specifically with like lengthened partials, right? So like if you're doing some sort of exercise, only doing half range of motion in the position where the muscle is most stretched,
so
right?
Like a squat first from off, the bottom to halfway up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Something bodybuilders have been doing for decades, but now we know it's actually more effective.
Yeah.
And he was talking about future research because there's research now comparing lengthened partials versus full range of motion, showing some benefit in the direction of lengthened partials, right? And so then I asked him, I was like, so can I incorporate this in my training by doing a set? Because I think that at least some of the benefit has to be simply because you can train a little bit harder, get the muscle a little bit closer to failure, right? Because when you can't do another full range of motion rep, you can likely do another two or three with a partial range of motion in lengthened position. Right? Think of a leg extension. You can't get the full rep. You can still get a couple in that lengthened position. So it's like, would it be appropriate to use it in that fashion where I do an entire set with full range of motion, and then when I'm done, I get a couple more reps in the lengthened position? Would that be beneficial? My perspective from like a common sense perspective is like, yeah, that would be beneficial. You're training a little bit harder, get a little bit closer to failure. And he was like, well, we can't say that because all the research is just complete lengthened partials versus full range of motion. I'm like, I get that. That obviously makes sense. But like, you could probably speculate that this is beneficial as well. And then he's talking about doing future research to test that, but then also seeing what the difference is between getting a full set of full range of motion and then a couple reps in the lengthened position versus doing one rep full range of motion, one lengthened partial, one full rep, one lengthened partial. And it's like, yeah, that is cool from the perspective of a researcher, but like, what are we doing? You know?
I also think that people get in the trap, and this is what I found through studying nutrition science, is that it's like the research almost just, that's the only thing that can inform. And like anything that doesn't exist in that world, like in research, it's just like, oh, well, we don't know. So like, does that mean you shouldn't do it? Right? Because the reality is that when I look at nutrition research, I see how much we don't know and how many gaps are. I don't see how much we know, because I think at a certain point in your development as kind of like an educated person in the field, you start to realize like there is so much unanswered. There's more unanswered than there are answers. So
yeah,
like, for somebody to just purely do things based on research, not that it's not important because it's wildly important, but you have to kind of have a balance between the two.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome, man. Anything else you want to chat about? Anything else you want to bring up?
That's pretty much it, man. I mean, it's good.
We need to do a over underrated episode.
We definitely do. I was excited. I thought we were going to do that today. So
let's schedule it. Let's schedule for like next week or the week after.
I'm totally down. What do you want to do? You want to schedule it right now? Let's do it.
Yeah. I'll send you my link and we can do that for both of our podcasts.
All right.
And for those of you guys listening, sorry.
Sorry. We're sorry for what?
In the sense we're just talking about random stuff now that probably people don't care about that much.
Oh, no way. I think this is great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think absolutely. It's great too. Absolutely. If we think it's great, it must be great.
It's got to be
great. That's just the way the world works.
And right? Everybody loves Joey, so you know they'll listen to everything you say.
Everybody loves Tyrone, man. don't throw the attention my way. It makes me feel awkward.
Do you want to do this on both, or do you want to do another episode on both? What do you want to do?
Totally up to you. I'll send you the link. Let's wrap this up, and we can chat about that.
All right, cool.
Where can people find you, man, if they want to connect with you, if they want to work with you?
Yep.
What are your
links? EatRightNutrition.com. Right is spelt like Rite Aid or Rite of Passage. So it's EATRITE Nutrition. Instagram is the same at EatRightNutrition. Podcast is also the Eat Right Nutrition podcast. And I'm trying to think about if I have any other links. As of right now, no. So that's where you can find me.
Sweet guys. And as always, all of those links will be down in the description if you listen to the entire episode. I appreciate you a ton. Thank you for tuning in. All I ask always in return is to show your appreciation by leaving a review and rating the podcast. If you're a regular listener, it really does help us a ton to reach new people. With that said, I'll catch you guys in next week's episode.